Welcome back, friends. Welcome back to the Film Literature in the New World Order podcast. I am James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and it has been an awfully long time since we've had an edition of FLNWO, so thank you for hanging in there. While I was busy pumping out the oiligarch documentary that I hope you've all had the chance to watch by now, but obviously I was so busy with that FLNWO got snowed under for a month or two. But here we are, back in a new year with a new episode of the program, and as promised, we're going to be talking about The Manchurian Candidate. Specifically, we're going to be focusing on the 1962 film version, directed by John Frankenheimer, produced by Frank Sinatra, and starring Frank Sinatra as Major Bennett Marco, based on the novel by Richard Condon, which was released in 1959, the movie coming out in 1962. And I hope it won't need a great deal of elaboration as to why we are focusing on The Manchurian Candidate. For people who are familiar with this podcast or my work generally, I think you'll probably already understand what we're really talking about here. But of course, this is a film which revolves around a very interesting plot that has something to do with the subject of mind control. And it's not quite as fictional as it may seem at first glance. But again, you probably already knew that, if from nothing else than episode 220 of the Corbett Report podcast, The Strange Case of Sirhan Sirhan, where we talked a little bit about the possibility that Sirhan Sirhan was something of a Manchurian Candidate-style mind-controlled assassin, or at least programmed to provide a distraction for the real assassin of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., or Robert F. Kennedy, I should say. But all of that being what it is, I think this is a fascinating topic to explore as it relates to the now declassified and now somewhat understood mind control programs of the CIA that actually did exist: Project Bluebird, Project Artichoke, MK Ultra, and their variants. And in order to help us piece through all of these various pieces of the puzzle, today we're going to be joined by Tim Kelly, who I hope you know from his podcast, Our Interesting Times. I've been a guest on that podcast myself a couple of times, and he has always got interesting guests with certainly some interesting commentary. You can check him out at his Podomatic page or on the UCY Network, which carries his podcast. I will include, of course, a link to the Podomatic page so you can go and subscribe to the podcast yourself if you haven't yet done so. Tim Kelly, thank you so much for joining us today on Film Literature in the New World Order.
Thank you for having me on. It's a very generous introduction. I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us about this extremely interesting book/movie. And I guess just to start off with, I, of course, having rewatched the 1962 version of the film in preparation for this conversation, I was struck again by just how interesting it is to think that this was still released in something like the tail end of the golden era of Hollywood, and still had that sort of early 1960s black and white feel-good gloss to it, that kind of feeling to it, before the splitting of the culture into subcultures and countercultures and all of the craziness of the 1960s. It still had a bit of a sheen of that innocence, but obviously a very, very bleak film with a very dark ending, one that I can imagine would have been shocking to audiences at the time. And certainly did, well, cause enough of a commotion that it disappeared from distribution shortly after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and disappeared for a decade or more. So an interesting film with an interesting pedigree, an interesting story, and so many different branches to follow here. Obviously, the main one that we want to be focusing on today is the very real and now declassified, or somewhat declassified, mind control programs of the intelligence agencies of the United States. But let's just start with your overall impressions of what do you think this book/movie was really actually accomplishing here? Why was it released in the late 50s, early 60s, a decade plus before MK Ultra or its variants were ever made known to the public?
Yeah, let's dispense with the idea that it was just entertainment. Just a movie, right? Yeah. There's something more to it. And you mentioned the revelations of MKUltra a decade later. It's what we've learned since then is that this seems to be some sort of limited hangout / I would say Cold War propaganda film. That was my impression. If you watched the movie, I'm going to assume the listeners know what happens. And you know, it's about a story about a platoon, an intelligence unit that gets kidnapped and taken somewhere in Manchuria, and they go into hypnotic techniques and other brainwash techniques, and they return, and the Raymond Shaw is this mind controlled assassin who then is controlled by his mother, who's also a communist spy / something. That's also up for question if you watch the movie a couple times. But one thing I do get from the movie is it does support the Cold War narrative. The idea is the evil mind controllers, the evil ones are the communists, and the Americans are portrayed very positively in the movie. One thing is you see the communist bloc is portrayed as sort of a monolithic communist bloc, because you have this room where this Fu Manchu doctor is demonstrating what he's done to the GIs, and it's filled of various officials from the communist bloc, Chinese, Russian. There's some sense of tension that they portray in the movie. So there's some sense of the Sino-Soviet split going on there, but they're all working together. And so, again, the notion here is that the mind control program is instigated by the communists. So what's funny is in 1962 or 1959 with the novel, that story is being told, although at the time it was not known that the Americans had instituted their own programs, at least officially in 1953, with Bluebird. But we know now that that experimenting on mind control or altering human behavior dates as far back as World War II. But really, the official memo went out, I think it was April 20th, 1950, with Admiral Hillen Coulter, who was the CIA director, approved research into that. So it predates the Korean War, although the official story is that America was facing what they call a mind control gap.
Like the missile gap, right?
Or the mine shaft gap from Dr. Strangelove, right?
Yeah. Right, right.
And that was Alan Dulles, and there was all types of hysteria that the communists were trying to declare brain warfare, mental warfare on the West. And so that was the justification for what we now know, that the program actually predates the Korean War. So that excuse, is not valid for the program itself.
Right. And you raise an interesting point, because of course, obviously the enemy here, the kind of nebulously defined, more inferred than really understood enemy here is that kind of Soviet Chinese communist threat, somehow defined. But I thought the interesting part of it was that they do have agents in the United American agents who are helping them along for whatever reasons exactly. Raymond Shaw's mother is involved in this, obviously for her own political power and what have you, and she says she's going to make them pay for what they did to you. But
yeah, at the end, yeah.
Yeah, but one wonders how much she really cares about what they did to her son anyway, because she did go along with the plot. So that's an interesting sort of wrench in that works, but perhaps just for narrative purposes. But still, it's kind of, I guess the plot ends up being something like a false flag, where the assassination presumably is going to be blamed on communist forces, but then used to consolidate power for a hidden political sleeper agent in the United States for the communist forces themselves. So there's a lot of revelation going on here, even if it is misdirection.
The speech that that Senator Iceland is supposed to give after the presidential candidate is shot dead is written by the communists.
She said, yeah, it's been worked on for 8 years or something.
Yeah, something by the communists. But then you start to think, well, wait a second. Then you have her mother's plans to bury them in the dirt or something for what they did to her son. If that, as you say, if that's really her motivation. But then you start to think, well, is this some sort of like false dialectic? Then you start thinking about the Cold War in general and Anthony Sutton's research. And you think, well, who's really pulling the strings here, right?
Yeah, right. Really, yes.
And so what is the movie revealing here? It's one of these things where and of course, what we do know through various researchers, Colin Ross and John Marks and Walter Barrett and their books on the topic, is what the communists were accused of doing in the movie actually occurred during the the Bluebird and MKUltra research in the 50s and 60s. I believe the murder of Frank Olson, I think officially it's still a suicide, but it's heavily suspected he was murdered.
Yes.
I think his breakdown occurred when there's some experimenting going on, some North Korean prisoners, a mind control experiment, I think, and they were taken. I'm not sure if the North Korean prisoners or just soldiers themselves. We may have the detail wrong. But apparently some soldiers, I thought they were prisoners, but I might have that wrong, were taken. The program didn't work, and they were made to bury their own grave and then shot dead.
Hmm.
And Frank Olson witnessed this, and that's when he had his breakdown, and that's when he was given the LSD concoction at Deep Creek Lake in Maryland and set him on this path where he eventually, dove out the window, supposedly.
Yes. Well, let's talk a little bit about the specifics of these programs, or at least what we've been allowed to know about them. And that in itself, I think, is interesting. But anyway, Project MKUltra is now, I think, that has seeped its way, I think, more or less into the public consciousness. It's not a subject that is completely unfamiliar to people. It has worked its way into a few movies in one way or another by name. So I think it's more or less out in the open now. And it was in the 1970s, the Church Committee gave the first revelations of it. But of course, this was an iteration of the CIA mind control program, but one that was largely conducted in research and research institutions by medical professionals and things of that nature. But perhaps the more interesting aspects of this come from the earlier iterations of this, like Artichoke. And I do have a January 22nd, 1954, almost 62 years to the day, a report on Artichoke that talked a little bit about some of the aims of that program, including the question of the age-old question, can an individual of redacted descent be made to perform an act of attempted assassination involuntarily under the influence of Artichoke? Again, I mean, it's the exact question that, of course, is played on in this movie, and as I detailed in episode 220 of the podcast, very much comes into play with the question of Sirhan Sirhan and what happened with RFK. So, and there's much more detail here in this document where they talked about at least the problem that they were attempting to solve in 1954, and they phrased it this way: as a trigger mechanism for a bigger project, it was proposed that an individual of redacted descent, approximately 35 years old, well-educated, proficient in English, and well-established socially and politically in the redacted government, be induced under Artichoke to perform an act involuntarily of attempted assassination against a prominent redacted politician, or if necessary, against an American official. The subject was formerly in redacted employ, but has since terminated and is now employed with the redacted government. Again, just a fascinating document, just from what they're putting here. And of course, this is phrased as some sort of, theoretical, can we do this? And ultimately, they conclude not quite with the technology we have, at this point. It would be extremely difficult. But again, this is only what has been declassified. And I think that's one of the interesting aspects of this. Again, at the time of the book, at the time of the movie, this was completely unknown to the general public. This was not in the it was not declassified. It was still classified at that time, still ongoing at that time. It wasn't until 1975 and the Church Committee hearings that the public got their first taste of this information. And that does raise the question, which I believe has been raised by H.P. Alborelli Jr., writing about the death of Frank Olson, that the revelation of MKUltra in the 1970s was an attempt to limit the hangout, to prevent researchers from looking at the darker deeds of Project Artichoke, which was more about the operational details and field work that was done along these lines. Let's talk about some of the CIA mind control programs and some of the people who are who have been behind this or associated with this. What do we know about this?
Well, we have the principal actors with what's Dr. Colin Ross calls the CIA doctors, and that would be people like Jose Delgado, of course, Ewan Cameron up at McGill University at the Allen Memorial Institute. You have George Estabrook, who's actually his research predates MKUltra, goes back to as far as the World War II. He openly talked about, I think, creating mind-controlled assassins. So that's what he bragged about being able to achieve with his research. Other ones you have Dr. Louis Jolyon West, a very interesting character. He's almost like a Zelig-type character popping up, whether it's Jack Ruby I think he met with Sirhan Sirhan. He met with Patty Hearst, and the reports they also met with Timothy McVeigh. So there you go.
Quite the pedigree. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was Colin Ross was talking about. Said, yeah, you have Jack Ruby shot dead in Dallas. So who do you call? You call Jolly Weston from California to come in.
Yeah. Exactly. Makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because there's no psychiatrist in the Dallas Fort Worth area.
Yeah.
So some of these characters, that there were some interesting figures like Ewan Cameron, who was, I think, at the top of the heap of the psychiatric community. He was the head of the World Psychological Association, the Canadian Psychological Association. So these are big names. And I think under the rubric of MKUltra, I think the entire field of psychiatry was co-opted, as also dozens of universities and corporations. What's funny, you think things like J.P. Morgan were contracted for it, and also the Scottish Rite, Freemasonry. So you really go down the rabbit hole when you look into this stuff, the connections, because you realize how all these organizations, whether it's military, intelligence, universities, corporations, they're all connected, and it kind of gives you a glimpse into sort of the matrix of how it operates. It's almost like, with Gladio and P2, how they use this Freemasonic lodge in Italy to carry out some of these criminal activities.
Exactly.
Same with organized crime, right? Because it's all kind of – they're all kind of – these organizations are very similar, whether it's intelligence or organized crime or Freemasonry.
Yeah. Secret societies and secret intelligence agencies, very much similar. This, of course, I mean, again, just given the level of detail of what goes into this book/movie, clearly there is some actual knowledge of that's going on here. This wasn't just dreamt up by some, Hollywood scriptwriter. This was obviously something that, well, I guess we'd have to point the finger at Richard Condon as the author of the novel, as having some basis for this information. And for people who haven't, I have started reading the novel. I haven't finished it in time for this conversation, but I was surprised to find it was actually extremely well written, and I'm excited to read the rest of it. So that's delight. I was expecting something more like a pulp novel of questionable value, but actually it's quite well written. And so looking at Condon's biography, I note he was born in 1915 in New York City and died in 1996 in Texas. And he was in the United States Merchant Marine at the time, I believe, of the Korean War. So I'm assuming there must have been some access at some point that he had to some intelligence information. Do you have any information on what Condon's role might have been, or what he may have seen when in his time in the Merchant Marine?
Nothing concrete, but I did run across this with Dr. Colin Ross was giving a talk, and he during his research into MKUltra, he was looking at the Bluebird Artichoke documents, which are the precursors to MKUltra. Bluebird became Artichoke, and then Artichoke became MKUltra, then MKUltra became MKSearch. In the 70s, I think. That's how it goes. But chronologically. But he says, going through these documents, he came across a memo that was written by one CIA agent to another. And this is dated, I think the memo was dated 1952. And it reads, in part, "We need to investigate the allegations that a group of American GIs has been captured while passing through a zone in Manchuria, has been subjected to hypnosis and other brainwashing techniques, and has amnesia for that period of time." Now, that is the exact plot of The Manchurian Candidate, the novel and the movie. So it strains credulity to believe that Richard Condon,
just a complete accident,
wasn't fed some information into this stuff. And, of course, the CIA and publishing, just like CIA and entertainment, I think as early as 1970s, it came out during the hearings that the CIA had published over 1,000, had overseen the publication of over 1,000 books. And so we're reasonable in suspecting that this was at least shepherded or at least aided by the CIA. And
Well, if we really want to get out onto that speculative limb a little bit, the question of tools for establishing mind control over various victims has come up in the past with regards to certain works of literature or film that are supposedly used in indoctrinating people into these types of actions, including The Wizard of Oz has been talked about as one of these works that is used by the intelligence agencies when they're working on one of their mind control victims. Catcher in the Rye has been talked about in that regard. Has The Manchurian Candidate, either the book or the film, ever been talked about in that regard? I don't believe I've heard of it being used, but...
No, I've never seen it as a trigger. You think they might be, you know, one of these patsies they throw it in there because he's inspired by this book or something. You think,
right.
Maybe they think it's just too obvious.
Yeah, it would be a bit too obvious, wouldn't it? I guess it would lead people directly back. But again, it raises to my mind really the question of why the intelligence agencies would leak this information to someone like Condon or show it to him.
Like I said, if you read, I think you're reading the book, maybe you get this impression from the book. I get the impression from the movie that it does back up the Cold War narrative.
Yeah.
And basically, you know, it portrays the Jason Bourne movies do this as well, and some of the other, whether it's Mission Impossible movies and things like that, they kind of show it's always rogue this, rogue agency.
Yeah.
But the system is self-correcting. But so does 7 Days in May, another Frankenheimer film, by the way.
Interesting.
It gives us the impression that within the system, at least there's competing. There's somebody trying to support the Constitution. There's honest soldiers who support the Constitution.
And of course, they usually win in the end.
Yeah, and of course, the real life is they don't have to bother with a coup.
Yeah, exactly.
Because Praetorians run the show anyway.
Exactly, yeah. Okay, well, before we get into Frankenheimer, who I think is interesting, before we leave Condon and what his role may have been, there's an interesting post that I will link to. I'm not sure I completely buy into it, but it is interesting, by John Bevilacqua, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, that was republished on the Constantine Report a few years ago, talking about basically an encoded message in The Manchurian Candidate, or that he asserts was encoded into The Manchurian Candidate. And I will let you read through the entire post for all of the detail, but I think some example of that can be garnered from this part, where he says John Yerkes Iselin, which is a really strange name the vice presidential candidate who is assassinated at the end. John Yerkes Iselin, which is an anagram for Johnny, as in John E, the letter E. John E is Ray S. Klein. That is the anagram. John E is Ray S. Klein. It's a perfect letter-for-letter basis anagram, and he asserts that Ray S. Klein is who Condon implicated, the same guy who ran the World Anti-Communist League during its most pro-fascist heyday during the 1980s. What this implies is that people like Wycliffe Draper and one of the people he funded at the Pioneer Fund, Dr. Hans F. Eysenck, let the genie out of the bottle after they discovered how to create Manchurian Candidate programmed assassins. Anastas von Sviatosky used Pavlovian and Chinese techniques in Manchuria, China, during the Japanese occupation to train unwitting victims how to be programmed assassins. And it goes on from there, but that gives you at least a taste. And that, I mean, I don't know what to make of that exactly, but it is at least fascinating, the idea that there could be some very juicy clues embedded in here. Perhaps this was an attempt, a genuine attempt by Condon to get this knowledge to the public.
Yeah.
And that's a fascinating possibility. Let's concentrate a bit on Frankenheimer, because you did raise Frankenheimer and some of his other movies. Of course, I think something that has to be talked about in this connection is his weird associations with JFK and RFK. Do you know a little bit about that story?
Well, it is reported that the night before Robert Kennedy was assassinated, he had dinner with the senator, and also with Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski and Mama Cass Elliot. And he drove Senator Kennedy to the Ambassador Hotel, to where the senator was to celebrate his victory in the Democratic primary. Given the fact that that Senator Kennedy was murdered, and of course allegedly murdered by Sirhan Sirhan, but Sirhan has all the makings of a mind-controlled assassin, very much like in Frankenheimer's 1962 movie. And so that's very strange. And of course, this also links RFK. Now, this is very tenuous, and I understand that, so that's fine. But, I mean, we're stretching a bit. Of course, this links RFK murder to the Tate murders, the Manson murders, because it's alleged that maybe Sharon Tate had some knowledge of the senator's murder, and that might have been one of the reasons for her murder the following year. Of course, her father was a military intelligence officer, Colonel Tate.
Right.
So, but again, this is all speculative, and I don't know what level of disinformation we're getting when we get there.
There are some fascinating connections there, though, that connect to the Manson and this the RFK assassination, and Frankenheimer, who, of course, had one of his films pulled from circulation as a result of the assassination of JFK, mm-hmm. and then drives RFK to his death, basically. I mean, just strange things like that. And for people who want some more information, I did link to a Media Monarchy interview with Peter Lavenda, who of Sinister Forces, who wrote about those types of connections, and James Evan Pilato interviewed him on that. And it's a fascinating conversation. I included that at the end of episode 220 on Sirhan Sirhan. I guess before we leave Sirhan Sirhan, we should note something that really stuck out to me on the rewatching of Manchurian Candidate in preparation for this conversation is the moment where Sergeant Shaw is being programmed by his mother, and so he has the cards in front of him. But she's called out to go talk to Senator Jordan, so she takes the Red Queen away so that he can't be programmed while she's gone. And then the daughter, who he's in love with, the daughter of Senator Jordan, comes in via the side door, and she is wearing... Supposedly, I guess just by random occurrence, she is wearing...
I don't buy that.
I don't buy that either. It cannot be, but it seems...
I just saw it in a window and I had to wear it.
Yeah, exactly. Strange. But so she is wearing, literally wearing a Red Queen dress, like a costume dress, which I thought was particularly interesting, given, of course, the Sirhan... One of the key aspects of the Sirhan Sirhan story is the polka dot dress. And that is supposedly could have been the trigger, or at least part of the trigger, for putting him in the range mode to begin the shooting. So, I don't know. That just really jumped out at me as something. Perhaps I haven't seen any documents that relate specifically to programming with patterns like that or with things of that nature. But it would at least make sense that there would be some sort of trigger to put someone in that form of mode. I don't know if you've seen anything on that specifically, though.
Nothing specific, but it is. It struck me as odd because the story with the RFK murder was you have a well built fetching young lady in a polka dot dress. That's how she's described. So she apparently had been giving Sirhan drinks the entire night and kind of escorting him around. So then you have in the movie you have Senator Jordan's daughter show up. Costume party, of course, in a Queen of Diamonds costume party. So it's one of those. Well, what are the odds, right?
Yeah. Again, that just I couldn't believe that they were expecting us to take that as a coincidence. I mean, I thought it had to be programmed.
Again, I think that could be a tell, or they're showing this is how these things. Some of these operations, some of these coincidences are so absurd, but we're told to believe them, right? Mm, like it's. I don't know. It's like the anthrax attacks, and we're led to the extent that people are aware of this, was led to believe that's a coincidence that although the anthrax attacks had nothing to do with 9/11 officially, 9/11 attacks, the wife of the editor of the photographer down in the newspaper down in Miami or down in Florida was Muhammad Atta's real estate agent.
Yes, right. Again, just one of those one in a million. Who would have thunk it?
Yeah. And so it's just one of those things. So maybe there's something there where we're led to believe that these coincidences just happen, and we're just suspend critical thought for the benefit of the narrative. The story will be.
Yes,
fed.
Yes. It's like I can't remember his name all of a sudden. The journalist who was beheaded, who just happened to have lent his laptop to one of the 9/11. Hijackers.
Pearl?
Yes, Pearl. Not Richard Pearl. That's a different
Daniel
Pearl.
Daniel Pearl, right?
Yes, Daniel Pearl. That's it.
Yeah. Apparently he just happened to lend it to one.
Yeah, someone who went on to be an alleged 9/11 hijacker.
Yeah.
What are the odds? So those types of coincidences, they really are. I mean, they really do basically put it in your face in a way that does ask you to believe something almost impossible to believe. So I guess there is some aspect of that, whether it was intended or not by Frankenheimer or whoever was involved in that aspect of the production.
It's almost like she's being set in there to screw with his programming, to reverse the engineering or do something with him.
Yeah. Exactly, yes. Well, I from a narrative perspective, I'm not sure how that makes sense. I mean, clearly, I guess Sergeant Shaw's mother was setting him up to to assassinate Jordan. And I guess I assume that his daughter was just collateral damage in that. But
yeah, because he's trained to kill anyone who happens upon right. the scene. She comes downstairs. Yeah.
Exactly. So. I don't know. Very interesting. There's a lot to puzzle out there. But I just finally on the Sirhan Sirhan note, I will ask people to go back and listen to episode 220, where I played some of the excerpts from the Experiments, the TV series from Britain with Darren Brown, basically replicating the RFK assassination by programming someone to go into assassination mode when seeing a woman with a red dress touching him on the shoulder, or a polka dot dress. So if that television show is to be believed, and you know, Darren Brown is a trickster, so maybe it isn't. But at any rate, supposedly this really can take place, and you can actually watch someone basically being programmed to do this. So fascinating, fascinating stuff. Again, there are so many different rabbit holes here, and so many different things we could explore. I guess we should touch on the issue of the 2004 remake that came out, obviously, on 4+ decades after the original movie, and 4.5 decades after the book, which I have poo-pooed a couple of times as not a very good movie. But you did raise an interesting point before we started recording about the subtle change to the narrative that's made in that movie, and what it might be telling us about the change in the overall narrative that they're trying to portray with this story. Can you tell the listeners about that?
Yeah, well, in the 62 movie, the enemy is the communist bloc, the monolithic communist bloc that the West is allegedly facing down in the Cold War. And Manchuria, of course, that's communist China. But by 2004, the Cold War, of course, is over by, 15, 16 years, if I do my math right. And so they need a new enemy. But strange enough, they still use the word Manchuria because they need the title Manchurian Candidate. But in this case, it's a global corporation, international global corporation called Manchurian Global. And it's a consortium of different corporations that are engineering or creating these mind-controlled assassins, and of course, getting the vice president. And in this case, I think the movie, the vice president is a war hero from the Gulf War in 1991, I think, if I recall. I haven't seen the movie in a few years, but getting him into the White House, I guess using an assassination engineer to get him into the White House. But the interesting thing there is the threat is a global corporation that profits off chaos and war, nonstop chaos and war.
Yes.
Which, you know, again, what are they telling us there? I guess they expect that most of the people who've seen the movie aren't going to really think it through think through the implications of that. But it tells us the enemy has changed. But what is the enemy? The enemy is what, the New World Order? It's Mr. Global. It's the corporations that really run the world, the elite, and they're just out there stirring up trouble, creating war, so they can profit off the contracts, the instability, and kind of like the IMF World Bank model.
No, I mean it's an interesting change, and I think that. I mean, there are, I guess, two ways of looking at that. I mean, maybe not mutually exclusive ways. One is that is just a reflection of the general milieu, that we are now in an age where that sort of thinking is au courant, that people can actually think along those lines, and it's more understandable and believable in our current context than some, I guess, communist menace or something of that sort. I mean, I guess they could have made North Korea the enemy or something, but it would have, I mean, it would have been laughable. But so it makes sense on some level. But then the other question is, well, then are we at this time being programmed for some reason to understand the world in those terms? And if so, by whom and for what purpose? I mean, is this revelation, or is it limited hangout, or what is it? And I'm not sure if I have an answer to that.
Well, are we being engineered to accept it? Sort of predictive program conditioning. We get that with the, I think that's part of, when you talk about trauma and mind control, and this gets into perhaps some of the more ambitious, less reported aspects of MKUltra, was it wasn't so much to create a mind control assassin or to target certain individuals, to create couriers or sex slaves, the more lurid stories. One part of, at least, MKUltra, it was to control the entire population, subjected to mind control. And that wasn't necessarily opiating them. Of course, I think we get that with Sub-Project 58. I think Jan Irvin did research on that with Life magazine, popularizing the magic mushroom and ushering in the psychedelic era. But that's only one element to it, because there's a dialectic being played there. When you mentioned going to this interview, is how the movie came out in the tail end of Hollywood's heyday, the classic period of black and white before we were subjected to all the, you know, the conflicts and strife of the 60s that was brought in with the Kennedy assassination. Almost, it seemed like there was like a that's the inflection
flipping
point.
Of the switch. Yeah,
yeah, that's even when fashion changes and all that stuff, and you the music changes. All of a sudden, you go from, you know, Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons to the Beatles, and the music changes. And, all, and some people have even done research with the music itself. You could say the music scene itself might have been some aspect of MK Ultra if you do the look at the research of Dave McGowan, more recently with John Potash and drugs, how these things can be weaponized. Entertainment is weaponized. And I think what happened with a lot of these things, with the 60s, you get the dialectic, you get the division, because you get the middle class reacting against the hippies and the counterculture, which is much of it was created by the corporations, by the think tanks, by the foundations, by the intelligence agencies. You do get this division, this sort of the separation within the generations themselves, the whole generation. Some argue that even the whole notion of the teenager was a creation of Hollywood and the corporations, you know, with the marketing of James Dean and Rebel Without a Cause and these things. Prior to that, these things didn't really exist in our psyche, our understanding of how we relate to one another. And it wasn't just the post-war prosperity and TV and music and the phonograph and the accessibility of the car. All that played into it. But interesting enough, in my research, I even found out that even the whole creation of suburbia, the interstate highway system, was all part of a military social engineering plan to fundamentally change the politics and culture of the nation. These things aren't quite as spontaneous as we think we are. And if we really do the research, we find out that we really are guinea pigs in a massive social engineering experiment that's been going on. And it branches out in so many different areas.
And when you put it in those terms and you bring in that context, I mean, it should give us pause for thought about all of the things we see going around us, and to what extent we are being led along a path, and to what extent we may even be participating in that without knowing. And that does raise the question for me. I mean, there has been such an uptick in the ideas of conspiracy in various television and television shows and movies over the last several years, that one wonders if we are being led into some sort of path, and what path that might be, and for what purposes, if it's just the age-old kind of dividing people amongst each other into the, you know, the credulous and the incredulous and things of that nature. But again, it really does put the question at the doorstep of movies and books like these, that are they trigger mechanisms? Are they revelations? Are they a bit of both? Are they programming us? It's always the question, and fascinating various threads that we can take from that rich tapestry. I guess we've covered quite a bit of ground here. Is there anything else specifically about your research on this book or movie that you wanted to bring up?
Well, books, movies, the arts, entertainment, these things shape how we view the world, what we expect of the world, how we view ourselves, and the powers that be that always exist, that presumably will always exist, aren't going to take a laissez-faire approach to them. And this type of manipulation goes back at least as far back as Plato and Allegory of the Cave. So we're not being too conspiratorial or paranoid to suggest that the movies we see, the books we read, the media we take, the food we eat, everything is being weaponized to one extent or another to manipulate us, to serve the interest of an elite, anointed elite. Again, it's just one of these things that to deny that these things aren't being planned is to deny the reality of social engineering. And social engineering is a fact, and social engineering by its very name requires some level of conspiracy, you know, and malfeasance on the part of those planning. So it's naive to think that the planners aren't planning, and the people that really run things aren't, you know, using their vast resources to manipulate the affairs of man that serve, you know, in their interests. And the evidence is there if you do the research. Just to take time, just like if you go over these things, it almost sounds like we're rambling, going on and on and on because there's so much to it. But you have to take the time and maybe turn off the idiot box and read, and connect the dots. When you start to connect the dots, you start to see the plan.
Unfortunately, there's no shortcut to this type of information and the real depth of what's going on here. And a public that is unwilling or unable to do that type of research or just sit down and read a book is a public that is going to be at the whim and mercy of these larger operations that are being performed on them, whether they know about it or not. So that's really the raison d'etre of this whole podcast series, is to try to understand that these things that we just passively consume as entertainment are not entertainment. And it's all, how you pull that puzzle apart may depend on your stances and your historical knowledge, but at any rate, it's certainly a puzzle to be pulled apart.
And the cinema, particularly movies, are very important because they capture words, imagery, and music. Right?
Yes.
So that's very important.
Yeah, it's very powerful, medium. And as you say, I mean, the study of the effect that fictional works has on people, the real emotional impact that it can have and the effect that it has on their worldview has been talked about, openly talked about and studied since the time of the ancient Greeks. So, again, if we're ignorant of that, it's at our own detriment.
More recently, we have Edward Bernays and Walter Lippmann.
Of course, yes. Well, exactly. It's been really weaponized and made into a scientific technique, but it's always been there to one form or another. All right, again, a lot of ground covered, so I think we're going to leave it there, but I hope that people got something out of this movie and or book. As I say, I'm reading the book, and it's actually quite well written, so I would tentatively recommend it based on what I've read so far. But we'll leave it there for now. I hope people will check out Tim Kelly's podcast. It's called Our Interesting Times. The URL is rather unwieldy, so please do go to the show notes and follow the link from there to download some of the past episodes. Tim Kelly, thank you again for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
All right, friends, there goes Tim Kelly, and there is another edition of Film Literature and the New World Order. And as I say, we are back on track for a regular monthly series, so don't fret. What is on the plate for next month? Well, before we get to that, why don't we, as always, take a tour through the comment section of the previous edition of Film Literature and the New World Order at CorbettReport.com, where we had a number of comments, as always, on our last edition of this series back in September when we were talking to Jay Dyer of jaysanalysis.com about The Prestige. So, for example, we had Orenda Review leaving a correction, which I guess it's been so long I don't really remember this, but apparently there was a misattribution to Arthur C. Clarke of the Three Laws of Robotics, when Clarke's Three Laws, not Asimov's Three Laws of Robotics, Clarke's Three Laws are the Three Laws of Prediction formulated by the British science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke. And Orenda Review copies them into that comment there, so you can go and read about that. We had Eric writing, excellent episode. I enjoyed this film when it first came out, and my appreciation of it has certainly deepened from listening to this discussion, which delved into layers of complexity that I hadn't yet explored. The similarities between statecraft and stage magic are many, and yet I hadn't ever thought of The Prestige in this light. It helps answer a question that has always vexed me. Why do people still support politicians, watch mainstream news, or vote when the fraud of these institutions is so obvious and well documented? They don't see it because they don't want to see it. I once saw a show about magicians' tricks revealed, explaining how all the stage magic tricks of David Copperfield and the like are done, and it now makes me wish that someone would make a documentary or show revealing all the political and economic tricks that are used to manufacture consent and steer the public into supporting outrageous policies. It's also worth mentioning that before I saw The Prestige, I had never even heard of Nikola Tesla. It seems to me that this film helped pull Tesla, whom I consider to be a great man, out of obscurity and into the minds of the masses. An interesting comment. Also, on the flip side of that, we had Alice88 saying, I didn't care for this film when I saw it years ago, and after this analysis, I still don't care for it. Lots of violence, a woman drowned before the viewer's eyes. The film also undermines the family unit. Wife and daughter may never really know who husband and father, who could be a pair of identical twins. Then there is adultery, ... And some more about Twilight language and revelation of the method. Also, an interesting comment from Sagned, who says, does somebody remember the nice little scene at the beginning of the film, The Recruit, where CIA man Al Pacino meets youngster Colin Farrell for the first time? "Nothing is what it seems," is Pacino's slogan all the time, and he introduces himself with a newspaper magic trick. The filmmakers made their point well, suggesting a deep connection between magic, media, and intelligence agencies. And then he leaves a few links to various other works mentioning the connections there between media and magic and intelligence. All right, lots of discussion there. And as always, please do get your comments in about this conversation so that we can go over them next month. But what are we going to be discussing next month? Well, we're going to do something, I believe this is a first here on the Film Literature New World Order podcast. We're going to listen or watch a relatively new release. So I hope it's still in theaters for you, wherever in the world you may be living. It's The Big Short, which you may have heard about. If not, of course, the link will be in the notes for this edition of FLNWO for you to get caught up. And I'm looking forward to talking to you again next month. Once again, this is James Corbett, CorbettReport.com.